Okay, cool. Morning, Rabbi Sai. So with us being within 30 days of Shavuot Sabbat Tammuz, and it'll be Rosh Chodesh Tammuz next week, Monday, Tuesday. So we've been moving over slowly from the Simcha, if you like, of Shavuos, the Simcha of Shavuos, the happy times, and we're moving into more difficult times. These manim were always difficult for Klal Yisrael, the period around Iyar Sivan in the summer, the early summer, the spring, and we'd started discussing the Asar HaRugei Malchus. Why? Because the three of the Asar HaRugei Malchus were, today is the Yortzeit Wednesday, which is Chofei, is the Yortzeit of three of the Asar HaRugei Malchus, Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha Kohen Godel, Rabbon Shimon ben Gamliel, and according to the Nitei Gavriel, there was also Rabbi Chanina Sgan HaKohenim, and we discussed already that Rabbi Chanina Sgan HaKohenim is not mentioned in the two versions of the Asar HaRugei Malchus that we have. And again, I need to find out. I imagine there must be a source to say that he was one of the ten. Interesting is that we have two versions of the Asar HaRugei Malchus. They both mention Asar HaRugei Malchus, that there were ten HaRugei Malchus. We've got the Eile Ezkero, which we say on Yom Kippur after the Avodah in Musaf, in which we mention the Asar HaRugei Malchus, and then we list them out. And there are Taka Asar HaRugei Malchus. There are ten names which are listed. Rabbi Chanina Sgan HaKohenim is not one of those ten names there. And there is actually a Medrash called Medrash Eile Ezkero, and I looked it up. It is on the Yotzei HaChochma. It was printed in Hamburg in 1853. From a Ksav Yad Atik. That's what it says, from an old Ksav Yad. But I don't know how old the Medrash Eile Ezkero is. But it basically, the Medrash Eile Ezkero discusses the Eile Ezkero that we have in Yom Kippur in greater detail. The story of the Roman governor calling in the ten the Asar HaRugei Malchus, the ten martyrs, and trying to equate them with the brothers who sold Yosef, filled his. We'll discuss that later in more detail. But that the Eile Ezkero mentions ten. Masha Enkein, the Arzei Halavonoin Adire Hatoyro, which is our kina that we say on Tisha B'Av when we're sitting on the floor, and we also mention, and it says there as well, Harugei Malchus Asoro, that there were ten tzaddikim. Only mentions eight tzaddikim, and the names that it brings down. It mentions only eight tzaddikim, and one of them isn't mentioned by name either, although he's referred to. That's Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. So you've got room for another two there, yeah, which are mentioned in the Yom Kippur ones, but not mentioned in the, you know, interesting just agav while we're talking, that this expression Arzei Halavonoin, it says Adire Hatoyro, and the name Adire Hatoyro got adopted recently as the title of the large kinnus of tens of thousands of Yidden B'nai Torah in a large stadium in America, and it's become now an annual event. They did it once, and now it's an annual event. Adire HaTorah. Yeah, and that expression comes from the introduction to the Asar HaRugei Malchus in the kinnus, which starts off Arzei Halavonoin Adire HaTorah. Those great people of the Torah, the wonderful people of Torah. And it's interesting that it should take place in a sports stadium, because the sports stadium was the place where the Romans killed many Eden, where they enjoyed their sports, where they venerated their sports, etc., etc. And we're taking now a sports stadium, which was almost a Roman invention. Maybe the Greeks as well also had large stadiums. But we look at the Colosseum in Rome and in other places where they had large stadium, or what the plural of stadium is. Is it stadia? I don't know. It is stadia? Okay, so they had large stadia across the Roman Empire for sports purposes, and we're taking their sports stadium and elevating it to Adire HaTorah. Okay, Bliade, we'll continue with our discussion tomorrow.
Started the Torah in Northwest London, Wednesday, Cafe 7, 10th of June. Rabbi Yonason Libman Schlitter, Director, English Department of Parachim. We don't always need the answers. This week's Torah is sponsored by Nishmas Reb Chaim Mendel, Ben Rav Tzvi, a friend of Rocha. Nishmas, our esteemed founder, Rabbi Yosef Dov, Ben, Shimon Michal Tzvi Itzkovitz, Zichrono Livracha.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Thank you again to the organisers inviting me to speak at Torway in Golders Green. It's an honour to be here. Very interesting title. I'm sure everyone's thinking we don't always need the answers in our Achim. So this is what people come to. They come to seminars and, you know, they want the answers. They want to get, you know, if they don't get the answers, so they think we're missing out. This isn't always the case. We're going to give you a very interesting encounter that Rabbi Aaron Levy, one of the top lecturers in Arachin, had when he went for the first time a few months ago to a certain kibbutz up north in Eretz Yisrael. So basically, let's see how this actually happened. To get invited to a kibbutz, someone who's Haredi, is not so simple. So the lecture was originally initiated by one of the kibbutz members who had actually just recently come and been a graduate of a recent Arachim seminar and became religious. So she actually had this encounter with the kibbutz members, and many were saying they were very encouraging to her that she'd now become religious, and they even encouraged and complimented on the change in her lifestyle. But there were obviously many members there who were very apprehensive. Why were they apprehensive? Because this particular person, as a child, was very opinionated, was very active in the kibbutz, and she was always involved in all the different topics. So these members were fearing, listen, she's going to come back, she's going to be the new Rebbetzin of the kibbutz. She's going to be making everyone bari tshuvas. So they were a bit taken aback. So this woman, who was the graduate of the seminar, said she took a lot of time to speak to them, to explain to them. She hadn't been brainwashed. Basically, she had just simply heard, and it had restored the Jewish knowledge in her that she had received, that the decisions she made herself, and it was the Judaism which she said she returned to also belonged to them, no less than her. They were still not convinced. So this was the challenge. She said like this, okay, you have arguments, you want to hear, I will invite you, one of the Arachim lecturers, to the kibbutz. Judge for yourselves. You know, he's going to say very sensible things. I trust you. You know how to answer him. What are you afraid of? Let's do it. Let's set it up. So this graduate calls up Rabbi Aaron Levy, and she says, let's invite you to the lecture. So she explains to him how it all set up, the whole lecture, what we just explained, and this was the first time the kibbutz secretary on this certain kibbutz up north had approved a Torah lecture in the kibbutz in 80 years of the history. So this was real history. So he said, of course I can't not accept such an invitation. Of course I'm going to come. So this was the first part. But then she explained to him that you understand when you come to the kibbutz, you're not just coming to give a lecture and going home and they're going to listen to you. This is a test for you. It's an audition, she tells Rabbi Aaron Levy. They're going to be scrutinizing every moment, every word you say. So she asked him a favor. Just don't step on any landmines. Just be as nice as you can with them. So what's the next stage? What are we going to talk about on the kibbutz that they've never had a Haredi person, anything talk about, anything of Torah on it? What are we going to talk about? So the woman, the graduate of Arachim seminar, says, we're going to talk about the Holocaust. So we talk about the Holocaust. So that, why the Holocaust? Because it was taken a few months ago on the eve of the Holocaust Remembrance Day. What was the topic? The topic they chose was they wanted to hear about faith in Muna in the wake of the Holocaust. So he tells her, I'm not sure it's the best topic to talk about when we come to this kibbutz for the first time. It's a bit of an explosive issue. You told me not to stand on, you know, any landmines. But it's going to be heavily mined. Someone, a Haredi person, standing in front of Holocaust survivors who totally lost their faith. And you want to talk about faith in the Holocaust? So, listen, she said, I've worked so hard on this. This is it. There's no other thing to do. This is the topic they chose. She says, yeah, she agreed with Rabbi Levy that it's an explosive topic, but as I say, no choice. The encounter at the kibbutz happened. Where did it happen? It happened in the local kibbutz clubhouse. The rabbi walks in, about 30 people there, most of them you know, the old time kibbutzniks, you know, the real deal, not like today, the kind that still believe in the kibbutz ideal, even though they haven't been told kibbutzes have all been privatized. So they're sitting in front of him, looking very suspicious and reserved, and he feels the rabbi like he's a fisherman waiting patiently for the fish swimming near the hook just to make its first mistake, and he made it. Good evening, he tells everyone. I was asked to speak about Emuna, faith in the wake of the Holocaust. Is that correct? So there's an old gentleman sitting on the front row, and he says, yes, that's correct. He explained he was 12 years old in the Holocaust, and he says to the rabbi, he's just opened the lecture, would you be very grateful if you could explain to all of us what sin I committed for which it was decreed upon me to lose my entire family? Silence descended. Suddenly the organizer of the event had to speak to someone outside. Everyone's thinking, and they're gazing at him. That gaze that they gave the rabbi was saying, you wanted a lecture in the kibbutz? You got it. So everyone's sitting uncomfortable in their seats. You know, he's come far away. Let him speak. Let's hear. So this is how he addressed this old man who was 12 in the Holocaust, who had lost his whole family. And he starts making an introduction to the answer. First of all, he wants to honor him. You're older. Thank you for coming to the lecture and giving me the chance to speak. Since your presence adds great honor to the event, I will try and maintain the high standing and dignified status of the event. But to address your difficult and piercing question, I have to explain myself. To tell you the truth, the answer to the question is very short and very clear. But to give it proper weight, with your permission, of course, we have to make an introduction to the answer. This is how he started off. He gave over a story from Bat Yam, where there was an avreich who had met a particular Holocaust survivor. How did it happen? This particular avreich had attended one of the seminars that a Rabbi Aaron Levy had given for the Haredi public that dealt with issues of human suffering and faith. After the event, the lecture, the avreich comes to Rabbi Levy and he tells him, I have a story for you that will reinforce exactly the things you've just talked about. The avreich tells the rabbi, I live in Bat Yam. A few years ago, on Holocaust Remembrance Day, he was walking down the main street in Bat Yam, and suddenly he feels a tap on his shoulder. He turns around and he sees a decidedly older man in front of him. His face was red and agitated. He starts screaming at this avreich, are you a religious? And even before he could answer him, he lashes out, what kind of religious person are you? How could you be religious after everything I went to? Are you, and still stay religious? He says, I might not look it, but I used to be religious myself. But today, what I saw, he tells the avreich, shame on you. How do you still keep mitzvahs? How do you put on tefillin? Explain to me as a religious person. It's hard to say, but this is part of the, how could a Kodesh Baruch Hu allow such things to happen that even weren't done to animals? The avreich was just stood in shock. What did he want from me? All the people around heard all the shouting. They didn't understand what happened. They thought that this avreich had offended this older man. He just wanted to disappear. He didn't know what to do with himself. He was only attacking me because I was the only religious person in the area. And then he explained to Rabbi Levy, the avreich just simply started to cry. He stood there and cried, and he felt helpless, this avreich. I didn't do anything to him. Why is he shaming me in the middle of the street? And then the embrace happened. He said, I don't know how to explain it, but this is exactly what happened. Picture a young avreich standing in the main street in Bat Yam in Israel, facing off a Jewish Holocaust survivor who moments ago before had hurled such harsh words, and the avreich is crying. Then the shouting old man, the Holocaust survivor, approaches the avreich and starts hugging him like he's never been hugged from then until today. It wasn't just any hug, it was a strong, real hug. And the man said these exact words to the avreich. "Thank you, young man. You are the first person who understands me. You are the first who answered the questions that have been gnawing at my brain for decades." And then it wasn't just me crying, he said. Both of them were crying, and they were both hugging each other. He said, the Avraich says, he felt like a child being hugged by his father. It was an immense love that he said, that moments before were no less than the hatred that the words he had said to him when he first met him. He felt he was trying to connect through something he had lost in the past, this old man. It was like hugging a strange child just because the child reminds him of the child he once was. After he calmed down, so he says, "Thank you, I will never forget this." They kept in touch until this older man passed away, and at the funeral, the Avraich said Kaddish for this older man. What happened? The last conversations they had in the hospital, the older man, this Holocaust survivor, says he wasn't privileged to have children, but, and therefore I have no one to say Kaddish for me. I want you to promise that you will say Kaddish for me at the funeral. So the rabbi who's giving this over at the kibbutz, he says, that's the story of what happened in Bat Yam. So he says, I just have one question. The rabbi's telling the people, can you explain to me what exactly happened here? What causes a Holocaust survivor to just randomly attack an Avraich who doesn't know? He doesn't know. He just met him as a strange person. Why did he hug him? Did the Avraich answer the questions he asked? What exactly calmed him down that he saw the Avraich was crying? And besides that, does it sound logical that someone who now doesn't believe would be interested in Kaddish being said for him in his final moments? So he looked at this old man in the front row, who was 12 in the Holocaust, who had asked the question at the beginning, and he sees that he had lowered his eyes and there were tears in his eyes. It really does sound strange. It doesn't sound logic. Do you, Rabbi, have an explanation for this? So the rabbi says, I have an explanation. He's not sure if it's the right one. But since that everyone here doesn't have a better explanation, I'll offer mine. This older man from Bat Yam, he didn't have questions on a Kaddish Baruch Hu. He believed in him even before the Holocaust, and even when he was shouting at the Avraich in Bat Yam. He didn't have questions. He had immense pain inside him. He had anger in him. It pained him that he was forced to deny his faith. He didn't lose it after all. The faith burned inside him, and that is why he was so angry. He picked on the Avraich, because deep down, he very much wanted to be like him. The harsh sentences he was asking of the Avraich, not to judge him, he was telling that it wasn't his fault he looked the way he did. He was only like that because he'd gone through the seven levels of Gehenna while he was still alive. We can't judge anyone. He wanted to tell him that the old man was telling the Avraich that he was forced against his will, that he actually misses davening and praying, that he's now no longer able to pray. He didn't attack him to ask questions, this old man, or to get answers. The old man was looking for validation, and the tears of the Avraich granted that to him. They told him that he understands him, that he hurts with him, that he's not angry at him. That's why the old man hugged him. That's why he told him that he was the first to answer his questions. And that's why he chose him to redeem him when, from his torment, to say Kaddish for him in his final moments, because he says, if the Avraich understands me, so maybe B'Shemayim they'll also understand me. That's what the old man said to him. So the rabbi says, he learns from this story, the story in Bat Yam, that when people cry out from pain, you don't explain to them why they are suffering. You suffer along with them. You don't answer them. You don't answer questions. you don't answer pain. Sorry, you answer questions, but you don't answer pain. So here we have the continuation of the beginning of the lecture in the kibbutz, the question of the Holocaust and Judaism. So the man says, who was sitting in the front row, it could be that your explanation is correct. He'd actually by then calmed down. But do you still have an answer to my question that I said at the beginning? So he says, yes, I do. Only before I give you the answer, I'd like to give you, align you some expectations and explain exactly where I'm coming from. When a person asks a religious person to explain why a certain event happens, he's actually testifying about himself that he believes in Hashgacha Pratis and that he believes in the truth of the Torah. If he wouldn't believe, why doesn't he answer his own questions? Why does he ask specifically someone who's religious? What does a religious person understand about history more than he does? So the old man in the front row and the former Holocaust survivor, he says, you're right. Someone who doesn't believe in Hashgacha Pratis isn't going to, should ask questions to historians or to Holocaust researchers. He's not going to ask questions to rabbis. So the rabbi continues and he says, and what happens if it turns out that in the Torah that the Haredi guy, the religious person is studying, there are no answers to all the questions? What then? Who else can answer such questions? So the old man says, maybe prophets. So the rabbi says, but wait, what's going to happen if the question is asked in a generation where there are no prophets? So if it's written in the Torah and if there are no prophets, he asks, so where are we going to get the answers from? So it seems we won't be able to get one. The man agreed with him, the question he asked. But tell me something, the old man says. Did the Torah really write nothing about this? You don't see anything in Chazal, in the Talmud? There's no explanations to why such disasters happen? So the rabbi says to him, it depends on who you ask. Of all the disasters, Shem Rachim, the Holocaust is undoubtedly the most terrible and horrific disaster that's befallen the Jewish people throughout the entire exiles. This is what he explains to him. And precisely because of this, there is a debate, not among the historians, but also among the great sages of Israel. Is it an event considered an inseparable part of the troubles that have afflicted the people of Israel throughout history? Or is it a unique one-off event that does not connect to any chain of troubles? So the man says, what does that matter? So he says, it matters a lot. If it's an additional event in the sequence of exile events that we see, perhaps we can look back and we can learn and see what the Torah wrote about such events in the past. But if it's a unique event, the likes that's never been existed before, no event in the past can teach us anything about it. For we've already learned from our sages, the Chazal, that we cannot draw a Kal Vachomer inference if there is no similarity at all between the cases. So he goes on to the point he's getting to, where it's faith without answers. The old man says, so how is it the Jews continue to believe after the Holocaust? Isn't the question of such an event that befell Klal Yisrael sufficient enough to lose one's faith? What causes you to continue to believe if you have questions and you don't have the answers? So the rabbi says, that's a good question. And you know who we learnt it from? We learnt it from Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu asked the Kodesh Baruch Hu, please let me know your ways. He wants to understand the suffering of Am Yisrael that's going to be in the future. Why will a rich, righteous person, he has it good in this world, and you see also righteous people not having it so good. Kodesh Baruch Hu answered him. Did he answer him, the man says? So he said, not exactly. He answered him at first, but Moshe Rabbeinu challenged the answer. But Kodesh Baruch Hu told him that within human power, to be honest, you can't understand my calculations. So he didn't answer him. But despite that, Moshe Rabbeinu remained Moshe Rabbeinu. The same Moshe Rabbeinu who was the leader of Klal Yisrael and remained Moshe Rabbeinu even after Hashem didn't accept all his tefillahs to enter into Eretz Yisrael. So the old man says, so why did Moshe Rabbeinu remain like that? He didn't receive the answers. So he says it's simple. Because there is a difference between someone who believes in HaKadosh Baruch Hu because he met him and someone who hasn't. Someone who believes in HaKadosh Baruch Hu only because life is going good, and he's probably maybe going to stop believing when life turns a bit sour to him. But someone who believes in God because HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to him, he's going to be forced to acknowledge the existence of the Creator, even if life sometimes becomes sour in his eyes. Someone who met a Kodesh Baruch Hu is compelled to acknowledge his existence. And someone who acknowledges his existence cannot deny it. Even if he doesn't receive all the answers to the difficult questions, he will turn from a believer without questions into a believer with questions. He says, he goes on, from Moshe Rabbeinu we see that the perfect faith is precisely a faith that resides alongside questions. And that the strength of perfect faith is determined by the silence that accompanies not receiving all the answers. That's why, just as we exalt the Ness and the Gevorah of people who stayed alive after the Holocaust, no less that we're going to also exalt the Gevorah and the Ness of the people who remained believers after the Holocaust, who hadn't got the answers to their questions. So he says, the rabbi, this was the introduction to your question. But, as I said, why did the Holocaust happen? So the rabbi answers him, this is my answer, in four words, I do not know. He told him the answer was very short. Even though I don't know, the rabbi says, I continue to walk in the path of those who were murdered, al Kiddush Shem Shemayim, with those Shemirachim, what happened in the Holocaust, where the questions still arise. The answer is, I do not know, is not a testament to weakness. On the contrary, those who continue to follow HaKadosh Baruch Hu even after the Holocaust, they are the Giborim, they are the strength, the strong ones in my eyes. Even though they still have questions. So the old man says, and therefore, so what are you telling me? So we just continue to stay silent. So the rabbi says to him, it depends. For someone whose faith rests on religious feelings alone, so someone who's going to be a heretic is not believing, the logical solution to the answers, to the questions, is that they don't have answers. But for someone whose faith rests on the revelation of Mamad Har Sinai, where Kodesh Baruch Hu revealed himself to Kol Yisrael, the solution is faith even when there are questions. For you see the reality of the Kodesh Baruch Hu in his own eyes, even Rahman and Islam, even the furnaces of Auschwitz, that will not change that. So he concludes. He concludes, and he calls it a person who doesn't believe his pride. He says he wants one more point to conclude. When everyone got up, the old man, who was 12 during the Holocaust, who had approached him, beside this old man, there was someone who was 40 years old, and he was a Bali Tshuva. So the man tells the rabbi, you know who this is? This is my son. I maybe have denied everything, but he became religious. So the rabbi says, are you ashamed of him? He says, not at all, I'm proud of him. Even more proud of him than my grandchildren. He says, with him, I still have scores to settle. When this cute boy of mine became religious, he started teaching me the halachas. He tried to teach me what's allowed and what's forbidden. And that, he says, that was already too much for me. For even me, who's someone who now doesn't believe. He says, up till then, he tells his son, you're not going to teach me Torah. I can teach you. He tells his son, you forgot where I came from. You forgot who my father and grandfather was. You still have a lot to learn before you teach me Torah. So the rabbi says to him, as he's departing, may you have a lot of nachas. He just says one thing. Can I ask you just one last question? Tell me. You tell me that after the Holocaust, you stopped believing. Do you know any other person who became a heretic who was proud of his son because he became religious? Do you know any other person who stopped believing who was angry that his son doesn't remember where he came from? So the rabbi says, so look, you're not really someone who doesn't believe. It could be that you're just in disguise. That you're actually a bigger believer than your son who became religious. So the man smiled, and he remained silent, and he had tears in his eyes. So he said, just that you know, when he left, because of heretics like you, the Mashiach will come. He tells the old man, in this life, there are no answers. But in Olam Haba, the next world, there are no questions. That's how he finished it off. And this is what is what Arachim is up against all the time. And they have to know that sometimes in life, as I say, he explained with this particular lecture on the kibbutz, we don't have to answer all the questions. Thank you.